Well, as you sit down, I'd be very grateful, as always, if you take the Bible and turn in the Old Testament to Isaiah 46, page 686. Page 686, Isaiah 46. You may like to take the notebooks and pencils from the seat pocket in front of you, because you may find it helpful to take notes during this sermon. And for those of you who perhaps haven't been around, in fact, I think we're just returning, aren't we, after a little break to Isaiah 40 to 55. So we have been looking at that. We've had a break, I think, in Revelation, and now we're coming back to these chapters in Isaiah. Yesterday, I was at the men's breakfast. After the breakfast, there was a very striking talk by a young dad who had for 10 years been a policeman. And sitting on either side of me were men who are not yet Christians, but both of them were clearly touched. And one of them asked me, "How do I know which religion is true? You're telling me about Jesus Christ, but Christianity is only one religion. How do I know that it, rather than the others, is true?" It's a burning question for us in the 21st century. Most of us meet people of other faiths regularly. Today, Catherine and I had two Hindus to lunch. Our children in RE classes are learning about Hinduism and Buddhism and other faiths. I've just returned from Nigeria. I spent most of my time in the north, where up to 90% are Muslim. I'm reading the Quran at the moment. So how do I know whether Christianity or some other religion is true? And it was also a vitally important question for Israel in the 6th century BC. Just to remind you, these chapters, Isaiah 40 to 55, were certainly written about and probably written in the 6th century BC. Israel had been totally defeated by the Babylonians, and the cream of Israelite society had been deported to Babylon. The Babylonian Empire believed in many gods, of which the chief was Marduk, or as he was also known, Bel, which means Lord. It seemed as if Babylonian religion had been proved right. Bel was victorious, and Yahweh, the Old Testament name for the God of the Bible, had been shown up as powerless. Or that's what you might conclude. So it seems as if several Israelites were beginning to ask, "How do I know which religion is true?" And in chapter 46, Isaiah, or rather God himself, sets out to answer that question. He says first, the true God carries his people throughout life. Isaiah begins with the false gods, with Bel and his son Nabu, or in Hebrew, Nebo. The Babylonian Empire and its gods may seem invincible now, but it has been revealed to Isaiah that in a very short time, the empire and its gods will come crashing down. That's exactly what happened when Babylon was defeated by the first Persian emperor, Cyrus the Great. And Isaiah sees this in advance, verses 1 and 2. Bel bows down, Nebo stoops. Their idols are on beasts and cattle. These things you carry are loaded as burdens on weary animals. They stoop, they bow down together. They cannot save the burden, but themselves go into captivity. So false gods are humiliated. They may look very impressive when they're in their niche or on a pedestal in some great temple in Babylon, But when they're loaded onto some ordinary animal who stumbles off with the retreating Babylonian army, they will be revealed as the shams they are. And far from acting to protect their people, they have to be carried. In verse 1, the Babylonian gods are called these things you carry. They can't even move without human and animal help. But the true God carries his people from the womb to old age. Look at verses 3 and 4 and see how many times words for carrying come. Verse 3, listen to me, O house of Jacob, all the remnant of the house of Israel, who have been born or carried by me from your birth, carried from the womb. Even to your old age I am he. Even when you turn gray, I will carry you. I have made and I will bear or carry. Another word to mean the same thing. I will carry and will save. Many of you will know the Christian piece called Footsteps. It's about a Christian walking along the sand with Jesus, and as they walk, they leave two sets of footprints. But looking back, the Christian sees that at certain times of his life, when things were hardest, there was only one set. And he thinks Christ may have abandoned him then. He asks, why? And Jesus replies, that is when I was carrying you. That's the piece of Christian writing, and many Christians love it. But the Bible truth is actually better still. God carries his people all the time throughout life. He carries us, says verse 3, when we're in the womb. He carries us, verse 3, again when we're a tiny baby, but he goes on carrying us, not only in bad times, but in good times too, so that when our hair turns gray, verse 4, he's still got us in his arms or on his back, and in old age, verse 4, he continues to carry us. So that's one difference. False gods have to be carried by humans. The true God carries us, his children. And that's also a great encouragement to me, and I hope to you. God our Father has carried us since our birth, or since we were first his, and will carry us. Most of us are fearful about something. Perhaps you're fearful about your exam results, or about going to university, or about leaving university and getting your first job, or about having your first child or another child. The God of the Bible, being the true God, will carry you through all of those if you are his. I'm into verse 4. I've turned gray. I'm fearful about retiring because my job means a great deal to me, and about losing my faculties. Actually, my children tell me I have done already. And about not being able to travel any longer, because travel is meat and drink to me. And about my final illness. I needn't worry. Even to my old age, God my Father will carry me and save me, because he is the true God. Second, God himself says here, the true God plans, promises, and acts. This is verses 5 to 11, and again, he begins with the contrast, with false gods. False gods are man-made. Look at verses 5 and 6. God says, to whom will you liken me and make me equal and compare me as though we were alike? Those who lavish gold from the purse and weigh out silver in the scales, they hire a goldsmith who makes it into a god. Then they fall down and worship. To make a god, an idol, like the Babylonian gods of Isaiah's day, or the Hindu gods or Buddhas of today, is an expensive business. It means spending significant quantities of gold and silver, and then on top of that, paying a craftsman. And how could one possibly imagine, says Isaiah, that a god made by human beings could possibly be a true god? And of course, a god made this way, being false, cannot answer anyone's prayer. Verse 7. They lift it to their shoulders, they carry it, they set it in its place, and it stands there. It cannot move from its place. If one cries out to it, it does not answer or save anyone from trouble. Look at the end of verse 4. I will carry and will save. The end of verse 7. It cannot save anyone from trouble. Once again, the god has to be carried, and in a great ceremony, put down in its place. It doesn't move because it cannot. And of course, not being able to move, it won't be able to answer anybody's prayers. By contrast, the true God is unique. He is, in the first place, incomparable. That's why this section begins in verse 5. To whom then will you liken me and make me equal and compare me as though we were alike? And you can't compare him to anyone else because he stands alone. There only is one genuine God, and that is the God of the Bible, the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. Verses 8 and 9. Remember this and consider. Recall it to mind, you transgressors. Remember the former things of old, for I am God and there is no other. I am God and there is no one like me. And the proof of this is that throughout history he has always planned, promised, and acted. That's what they are in verses 8 and 9, to remember. Those are the former things of old, which verse 9 mentions. I am God, he says, and then verse 10, declaring the end from the beginning, and from ancient times things not yet done, saying, my purpose shall stand, and I will fulfill my intention. Throughout the Old Testament, God has planned exactly what he will do, has sent prophets to tell his people what he's planned, and then has done it. He could only do that because he's the true, the unique God. So before it happened, he told his people about the exodus he had planned away from Egypt. He declared in advance what he would do through various judges who ruled over Israel, through Israel's second king, David. He told them in advance that the Babylonians would conquer them and Jerusalem would be destroyed. And all these things then happened. Now he was doing it again with Cyrus the Great. That's why verse 11 goes on, calling a bird of prey from the east, the man for my purpose from a far country. That's his way of talking about Cyrus the Great, the one who would a few years later conquer Babylon, whom Isaiah has mentioned by name in chapter 44 and chapter 45. God goes on, I have spoken and I will bring it to pass. I have planned and I will do it. And that was exactly what happened when Babylon fell to Cyrus. This is a bas relief or high relief, I think it is, of him. When Babylon fell to Cyrus in October 539 BC. So here is a distinguishing character of the true God. What God has promised in the Bible has happened and will happen. We can go on from Isaiah's time. God promised a return from exile in Babylon. It happened. God said that Jerusalem would be rebuilt. It was. And supremely, God planned and promised that his son would come to earth, would die for sin, and would rise again. It all happened. So now when he plans and promises that Christ will come again to judge the world and bring in a new heaven and a new earth, we can be sure it will happen. What the true God promises, he acts to fulfill. And third, the true God restores his people. Here in verses 12 and 13, the false gods are not even worth a mention. God simply speaks about himself. Verse 12. Listen to me, you stubborn of heart, you who are far from deliverance. I bring near my deliverance. It is not far off, and my salvation will not tarry. I will put salvation in Zion. I will put for Israel my glory. Despite Israel's stubbornness, and God calls them in verse 12, you stubborn of heart. And in verse 8, you transgressors or rebels. The temple will soon be restored. Zion, in verse 13, is the Old Testament's name for holy Jerusalem, and especially for the temple where God is worshipped. At the moment, it lay in ruins because the Babylonians had razed it to the ground. But God says in verse 13, I bring near my deliverance, it is not far off, and my salvation will not tarry, I will put salvation in Zion. And indeed, the temple was rebuilt shortly after this prophecy. And then God also promised his people will know the beauty of his presence. So this chapter ends on a climax. I will put salvation in Zion for Israel, my glory. Literally, I will give to Israel my beauty. Because when his people come back to their land, they will know his presence with them, and that presence will be beautiful. Radiant. He's not saying that Israel is his glory. He's saying he will put his glory in or for Israel. You know, we in this country, we Christians, can often become unnecessarily despondent. The fact is, God is showing the beauty of his salvation in many parts of the world. Many of us saw that in the Ugandan children who sang and danced here on Friday. And incidentally, if you missed them, there's an opportunity, as long as the tickets haven't sold out, of hearing and seeing them again this Friday, 7:30 in Mayfield Church. And you get tickets from the bookshop in Mayfield. I'm afraid I've totally forgotten the name of it, but it's something like Libris or something like that. in Mayfield this Friday. Nigeria, which I've just come back from, is awash with signboards and billboards. Around 50% of them, or very nearly, are about Jesus. This is just one example. Imagine driving into Tunbridge Wells and every second billboard was proclaiming Jesus. What's it like in Nigeria? God is, as Isaiah says, putting his salvation all over the world. And he will restore his people in Europe. We may feel that the former strength of the church in Europe lies in tatters, just as Jerusalem in Isaiah's day lay in ruins. But God will restore the ruins of his holy church and will put the beauty of his presence among us so that others may see it and be drawn to him and his glory. We'll be praying for Europe at PowerPoint this Thursday evening at 8 o'clock. And that will happen because it is a characteristic of the true God, says Isaiah, that he restores his people. So what does this passage, Isaiah 46, have to say to us in the 21st century? We're surrounded by many different religions, by the Jewish faith, by Islam, by Hinduism, and Sikhism, and Buddhism, and Shinto, and of course New Age ideas, as well as Christianity. What do I do when so many religions claim to be true? And Isaiah answers, remain faithful to the true God. Look at what God says to his people. Listen, verse 3. Remember, verse 8. Remember again, verse 9. Listen, verse 12. In other words, listen to what is said in the Bible and remember your experiences of God. You have given your life to the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. Has he carried you throughout your life? From the cradle towards old age? When he sent his prophets and apostles to say what he has planned should happen, has it in fact happened? And is he restoring and extending his church in many parts of the world? Then stay faithful to him. Don't imagine that all religions say the same, which they manifestly don't. Don't think that every religion worships the same God, when the Bible clearly teaches there are false gods and one true God. So if you found him, remember him and listen to him. And whatever you do, this chapter is saying, don't be stubborn, don't be a rebel. Don't follow the crowd around you and gradually give up on God. That would be disastrous, literally ruinous. No, remain faithful to the true God. And second, put your confidence in the true God. That is, put your hope for the future in the true God. Because the true God is a God who acts and who proves himself utterly trustworthy. As he himself has said, I have spoken and I will bring it to pass. I have planned and I will do it. If he has proved in the past to be as good as his promise, he will do it again. Whether that is continuing to carry you personally into your old age or restoring his glory in the church in this country, or coming back in the person of his Son to bring this world to an end and usher in the new perfect world. The true God does what he says, which is why all our confidence, all our hope can rest and rest assured in the God of the Bible. Let us pray. Just a moment for us to come in awe. Our God is an awesome God. I stand in awe of you. To come in awe before the God who has revealed himself in this chapter, Isaiah 46. Our gracious and very great Father, you are the unique and only true God. And we praise you for the extraordinary privilege of having come to know that, to have that revealed to us, and to be the children whom you carry, whom as our Father you never give up on. So you carry us not just in the womb and as babies, but as we get our gray hair and into old age and beyond. We praise you and ask that in our thinking and in our speaking, we may remain throughout our lives utterly faithful and increasingly obedient to you. Not just singing that we stand in awe of you, but doing so here and in our families, at school and university, in our place of work, and in our retirement, to the glory of your name.